Ocelli Effect.
I'm a big fan of the show.
Chuck Ocelli, and he's been known for many years as a blind JFK researcher specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassinations, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media.
Chuck O'Kelly! Yeah!
So it is the 19th day of June 2019, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar, and this indeed is the Ocelli Effect. Now, we do broadcast live, originating from the facilities of Ocelli.com and played out in a few other places. Tonight, our only terrestrial radio outlet is in Ireland for the live show, but that's okay. The replays do travel, and you guys know that because most of you actually pick it up via the fondle slab of choice, the applicable application, etc., the podcatcher digital. Because you get it further on down the stream. Doesn't matter. Welcome to Woden's Day or the middle of the week. Hump Day, Wednesday, I don't care what you want to call it according to that thing we call a calendar. So this is going to be a special show. I'm going to dispense very quickly with any sort of allusions because we did start late for the live listeners who are going, wait a minute, why did the show just start? There was a few issues there, and I played a little music for you guys and whatever. Don't worry. I'll continue on the show a little later. You'll get the full thing. It is what it is. I have a special guest, Dave Emery is with me now. I do realize that there are a bunch of people who listen to my show who don't know who Dave Emery is. that happened when I said, oh, I'm really excited. I said on social media I was really happy that I was able to book Dave Emery. And a bunch of people messaged me and said, who is that? Look, if you're younger and you're not keeping up with things in a very deep sort of way, here's the thing. This is why I got to have Dave on the show. Okay, as far as I'm concerned, the fact that you guys don't know who Dave Emery is killing me. Now some of you do know who Dave Emery is, and you know why? Because he is an instrumental individual in a lot of different interesting ways. Now, first of all, as a broadcaster, in my estimation, and before we even get into his political leanings or his projects or his many, many years of research regarding the JFK assassination and indeed his involvement in the legacy of May Brussel, you know what? We're not going to talk about May Brussel. We're not really going to hover on the JFK assassination too much. Then again, I might lie to you about that, but I'm telling you now that we're going to get into a lot of different areas. Here's a key thing to remember, even if you've never heard of him at all. He is part of one of the most interesting things I have ever heard on a radio show anywhere. And you guys know I've listened to talk radio my entire life. So what happened? I actually might play it at some point during this discussion, and I want to get immediately to Mr. Emery, who is patiently waiting for me to get through all this. But see, Gordon Novell, who you've heard discussed on this show, certainly if you heard the Sinister History stuff, if you heard the JFK 101 stuff, if you heard the discussions of Jim Garrison, Gordon Novell's name comes up. And if you're saying to yourself, well, I don't recognize that name, all right, look, put it on pause if you're listening to the podcast. Go check it out. See who Gordon Novell was. He's an interesting character in history, period. But anyway, one day Gordon Novell called into this man's radio show. And it is one of the most fascinating, I don't know, 20 minutes worth of radio that I've ever heard. So as a broadcaster, he is unique. As a researcher, he is unique. He's an interesting guy, and I'm just really, really happy to have somebody who I have listened to off and on over many, many years. Dave is older than me by a bit. Certainly when I was younger, I was listening to him. And again, he was in that sort of nexus of individuals who was out there very, very early on. And I'm telling you guys right now, there is a huge archive of stuff you could go find in various places. And all you got to do is know how to spell Dave Emery's name. Today, you'd have to go to, let's see, what is it called? I don't work with notes, Dave, because I'm almost blind. But the fact is, it's spitfirelist.com, I think. That would be where you would go to begin to look at Dave's work. But here's the fun part also. I'm going to put all those links along with the metadata on the podcast and everything, so you'll be able to click on it and go there. Look at Dave Emery's work for yourself.
Hey, hello, Chuck. Chuck or Charles, which do you prefer?
Chuck, you know, and that's the other thing. Dave does not know who I am at all. So it's great.
I have a passing. I just wanted to say that you've been dropping out. I'm only capturing part of what you are saying. I don't know if that also extends to what is being recorded. and or whether I'm dropping out as well. But I'm just noting, if you're, for example, calling on a cell, I'm just, you know, you've dropped out quite a bit. So
well, actually,
I caught much of it. Yes, very quickly, as far as who and what I am, I refer to myself as an anti-fascist researcher. Perhaps the that would be best understood by the Sons and Daughters of ERA, who are listening live. I mean, Americans, you know, they think fascism refers to when they got busted smoking a joint when they were kids and their parents grounded them for 6 months. You know, fascism was described by Benito Mussolini, who called his system the corporate state. He said, "Il fascismo è il corporatismo." Fascism is corporatism, and it is just exactly that. It is. One friend of mine described fascism as capitalism on full auto. That's a reference, of course, to an assault weapon with selective fire, either semi-automatic, where you just pull the trigger and squeeze off one shot at a time, or you flip it and put it to full auto, and you just depress the trigger and it fires the entire magazine nonstop. I'm in my 40th year on the air. When I began broadcasting, Jimmy Carter was president of the U.S. The Iranian hostage situation had yet to take place, which was an early manifestation of the mullahocracy, which is now in power in Iran, and a major focal point of goings-on in the Middle East. And it was long before, way before the Internet, there was no such thing. I broadcast from the Silicon Valley. All of my life's work is, as you mentioned, archived on the SpitfireList.com website. I'd also like to put in a plug/request. It is also archived on a 32-gigabyte flash drive, which also includes the mini library, to coin a term, of old anti-fascist books on really easy-to-download PDF files. That can be obtained by a contribution of $65 or more, tax deductible if you are a U.S. taxpayer and itemized deductions. I get no money whatsoever from that. One of my home base stations, or my home base station, KFJ-CFM, does get that. It is a non-commercial station. But you want to talk about a bargain, and this is not to be egotistical. For $65, you can buy my entire life. It's a form of anti-fascist slavery, in effect. So that, in a nutshell, is who and what I am. It has been my experience, Charles. One of the most challenging things, if not the most challenging thing about life, and in particular about other human beings, is that so often the strong parts of their personality and the weak parts of their personality are a part of the same general personality configurations. You can't edit them. One cannot edit them as though they were a manuscript. You mentioned my late friend Mae Russell. That was very true with her. Mae was, and I mean this literally, the smartest person I've ever known in my life and the stupidest. There is so much about her work that was brilliant. I would not be doing what I am doing were it not for her and her, the better parts of her work, which were the greater part by far, are a foundational element, or the foundational element, of so much of what I do. My work, and I think myself as well, also manifest that same confounding element. What I do is irrefutable, frankly. I would go to the mat with anyone in intellectual combat about anything I've had to say, and I would win. I would destroy any potential critic. On the other hand, that is because what I do is very pedantically documented, and it is hierarchical. The things that I'm doing today are built on top of and often referential to the things I did decades ago. It is therefore very difficult for anyone to really plunge in, given the massive amounts of disinformation, given the attenuated nature of our media and the resulting, I think, attenuated consciousness of people, at least in this country and I think abroad, with mobile technology and social media and the internet. There is so much nonsense out there. There is so much disinformation. There are bots that are representing themselves as people. There are entire virtual personalities. There was something in yesterday's, I think it was probably on the East Coast 2 days ago, about an ostensible Brazilian musician and media host who, in fact, doesn't exist at all. This is a virtual human being, and they have a picture of her allegedly, I've forgotten the name of the pop star, but engaged in what appeared to be a lesbian encounter with some diva. I've forgotten who it was off the top of my head. It doesn't matter, and it is not a knock on her. But, in fact, this entire thing was bogus because that Brazilian pop star, media star, whatever, doesn't really exist at all. And then when you, when one combines that with Twitter, you know, 140 characters in search of an author, and Facebook, which is a sea of just the most heinous lies and deliberate misrepresentations and counterinsurgency covert operation, it is difficult, I think, for someone, particularly a young person who has grown up with all this stuff, which I did not. I am 70, so this all did not exist when I was young. It didn't exist really until a relatively short time ago. It is difficult for people, I think, to engage at length with hard documentation, particularly when that documentation is as necessarily referential as mine is. You made a reference to Gordon Novell. He was a veteran U.S. intelligence officer involved with Bay of Pigs, infiltrated Jim Garrison's investigation, pretending to be a willful supporter, and in fact was functioning as a double agent for both FBI and CIA. He then was recruited by Richard Nixon's White House, although he says, and others say, it never actually happened, to use a degaussing gun to electronically erase the Watergate tapes. He called in, it was not on my program, Charles. It was on, I was a guest late night on a talk show called The Expressway Show, on an AOR station here in the Bay, in the South. It was called KOME, and they used to have a lot of fun. They said, you know, you've turned to the cum spot on your radio, or you've got cum on your radio, and things of that kind. There was a guy named Larry Johnson, and he had me on as a guest. And I was just starting to relax. Most of the discussion was not very inspiring to me. I was dealing with a bunch of Stone rock and roll kids. This was in the wee hours. I think I went on at about 1 or 2 a.m. on a Monday morning, so well after midnight on a Monday morning, Sunday night / Monday morning. And I was getting asked about space aliens and UFOs and the zero factor and a lot of things that I, you know, had to really be polite about, shall we say. And then about 20 minutes to 3, when we were going to get off, a guy calls in with an obviously southern accent, very thick, and says, "Hello, my name is Gordon Novell," and he went on to, and at first I figured it was just someone playing games, and then I said, "My God, it is Gordon Novell." And he was, by his own account, and also that of Charles Colson of the Nixon White House, recruited to erase the Watergate tapes. Richard Nixon was in Dallas, Texas on November 22nd, 1963. He flew out about 2 hours before Kennedy was killed. Yet when the FBI interviewed him in February of 1964, he stated that the only time he had been in Dallas, Texas in 1963 was 2 days prior to the assassination. That, of course, would be November 20th. This, despite the fact that the San Francisco Chronicle and New York Times, among other newspapers, had interviews with Richard Nixon in Dallas, Texas, dateline November 21st, in which he was talking about various things. And that would certainly be enough to for a grand jury to indict him for murdering, being involved in the murder of President Kennedy under the consciousness of guilt principle, and it would be enough to convict him of perjury, since he was lying, obviously, to two agents of the FBI. If there was, there have been numerous accounts where the people, veterans of the Nixon White House, what Richard Nixon did not want to come out on the Watergate tapes. He was afraid that if the Watergate tapes became public, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing may come out, unquote. And veterans of the Nixon White House have stated that the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote, was a code word in the Nixon White House for the JFK assassination. And in an electronic, it was called Technology Illustrated in 1983, Gordon Novell wrote a letter in response to a critical comment in which he made reference to, quote, my ultra-high technology role to erase the Watergate tapes, unquote. And I asked him, he made a bunch of statements. He denied that there was any substance to Jim Garrison's investigation, and twice asked, said he was in charge of security for the Garrison investigation, which he was, and then was charged by Jim Garrison. What he was doing was he was an infiltrator, and twice he asked me, how can you go from being chief of security to being indicted or requisitioned as a defendant? I never asked that directly. I never said to him what I just said to you, and I never refuted his allegation that Jim Garrison was full of it, even though I didn't agree with any of it. I have taken a lot of fresh fertilizer over that because people said, huh, you should have raked them over the coals. And, well, for openers, I cited the sources for my statements, and he said, well, they're all frauds, you know. And Gordon Novell also had a reputation for being litigious. He would sue people with the assistance often of the intelligence community if he didn't like what they had to say. Mm. So that, although I did not mention that, it suggested that they were accurate. Simply the fact that he did not sue them. I never asked him, well, if they were frauds, how come you didn't sue them?
Well, I remember vividly, actually, you responded, I am very familiar with the way that you exert your influence when people make statements about you that you believe are inaccurate, is pretty much the way you responded to it, which was a real general sort of way of going, look, I know if this goes the wrong way, I'm going to get sued.
What I said was right? This, my exact words, I said, I want to make it very clear that I'm not gunning for you. I said this twice. I have a great deal of respect for the power you can wield. Those were my exact words. This guy was a veteran U.S. intelligence officer. He was involved with the Bay of Pigs. He was involved with killing President Kennedy. And there was it was not indicted. And there was no way in hell I was going to try to take him on. People said, well, you should have raked him over the coals. Well, you don't rake a guy like Gordon Novell over the coals. You will become a conspiracy theory if you do. It is very easy to be brave with someone else's life. They didn't have to go out into a deserted parking lot at 3 o'clock on a Monday morning and drive home. I did. I had no idea what was going on with my car. You know, maybe just, or, you know, who knows?
Matter of fact, he was in the area because he was listening to the radio at that time in the morning. So, you know, you could have been confronted by them. I mean, I'm not trying to make a joke here, but you could have literally been confronted directly or indirectly immediately following your departure from that radio station. And
you bet he could have. Yeah, he could have some of his anti-Castro Cubans out in the parking lot waiting for me.
Right.
You know, it's just... You know, people say, well, you should have raked them over the coals. No, only an idiot would do that, and then that idiot will become a conspiracy theory. Plus, the fact that I made it very clear to him that I understood how powerful and by implication how lethal he could be pleased him. It was accurate, and he's often been portrayed as a kook, you know, a disinformation agent or this or that. What he was, he passed away now, but he was a veteran U.S. intelligence officer who had been involved in some very powerful things. And, you know, again, he could wield a lot of power and do so lethally. And there was no way in hell I was going to try and rake him over the coals. I operate from published material, and I cited for him the sources for my information, and you know, he said, well, he's a fraud, and I cite another source, and he said, he's a fraud as well. Then I mentioned the Technology Illustrated material, and he sort of brushed that off. So I said, at one point in the interview, I said, quote, so in other words, you deny actually having erased the Watergate tapes. And he said, quote, only because they didn't pay me, unquote, and chuckled afterward.
Mm-hmm.
I then pressed him on it. He said, no, I want to erase all, I've forgotten how many there were, 364 or whatever. And I guarantee you President Nixon wishes I had.
Right.
But that is as close as anyone is going to get. If you were going to diagram that sentence, actually it's a sentence fragment, it would have been, I only deny having erased the Watergate tapes, quote, because they didn't pay me for having erased the Watergate tapes. You know, and I believe that, too. If they had paid him and he had a canceled check, he would have loved to embarrass these high rollers. And this is true of a lot of intelligence officers. They get used, and then the people in power, the people in the limelight who have used them, sort of brush them off. And I think Gordon, if he had a canceled check, probably would have come forward and said, "Hey, folks, you know, they paid me for having done this," you know. And
right. Well, the interesting thing about him too is even long after you spoke to him, and you know, at other times, he made a lot of interesting public statements that made it sound like, listen, even though I was involved with a lot of interesting people in the intelligence community, I know things. I do distinctly recall not an interview that had anything to do with you, but he is one of the people who is most often cited regarding, you know, J. Edgar Hoover's proclivities, let's call them. You know,
I don't think we have to euphemize. J. Edgar Hoover was gay. And the number two man in the FBI, Clyde Polson, was his live-in lover.
Absolutely.
I mean, this has been absolutely established.
Oh, no, I got you.
He was blackmailed.
but
he was
the thing about,
because of that.
Yeah, but the thing about Novell is that he would claim to have specific knowledge of where the photographs are that prove this indisputably, you know, and that was the thing. He was making those statements long after J. Edgar Hoover was dead, you know, and certainly making assertions that he always seemed to know something else about the situation, no matter what situation you were trying to discuss with him. And here's the thing. I absolutely support your healthy respect for when you're dealing with somebody who operates in that world. You know, I have had discussions that I cannot air, that I cannot share with individuals that I've encountered whose names are not quite as well known as Gordon Novell's, where it's just like, look, I am not going to press on this guy because I realize exactly what I'm sure he used to do. And anybody who tells you that they're ex-CIA is selling you something. Because there's no such thing as ex-CIA. These guys who have just the same criminal underground connections that they always did have them for the rest of their lives. That's the way I see it, and that's the only reason why they're still alive, usually, quite honestly, because otherwise they would be more of the disposable type or of the bureaucratic type, in which case you have a whole other, you know, issue. You can possibly press the guy who used to be the, you know, deputy and used to be the publicly known head of parts of the agency and stuff like that. But when you get into the real underground part of this, the real dirt under the fingernails, so to speak, you're dealing with people that you better have a healthy respect for.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely. I mean, the President Kennedy, okay, and he's been dead for more than 50 years, was the president of the U.S., and he was going against the grain. He was swimming against the tide, and they put him down like he was a pimp on a downtown Saturday night. The official version of the JFK assassination is pure unadulterated fresh fertilizer. It is nonsense. And the official version is not only demonstrably wrong, but it is in its fundamental aspects physically impossible. And it is ludicrous. And yet, all of our media and our even most of the so-called alternative media, and note my use of the term so-called, stick to that lie. And they stick to the same lie about the killing of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, the 50th anniversaries of which were just over a year ago. And the comedian Mort Saul, who is still alive, thank God, he is one of the originators of real stand-up comedy and a brilliant guy and a politically oriented guy. And he became one of Jim Garrison's volunteer investigators. And in his autobiography called Heartland, published in 1976, he asked, quote, how many lies before you belong to the lie? And that is, I think, a deceptively simplistic or simple-seeming statement. You know, when you are a journalist, whether it's broadcast or print, you have to earn a living if you're going to make, you know, if you want to establish any prestige, and you are going to be answerable to your editors and or commercial sponsors or producers, and you're not going to be able to go on and say, you know, most of what you have been told is a lie, and it can be proved. They hear blah 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 blah. You'll be fired because that means that the people who have been presenting you these lies over decades were lying, and that means the commercial sponsors, corporate in nature almost always, were underwriting and paying for these lies, and that doesn't work. In academia, if you are the chairman or chairwoman, I suppose, of a history department at a major university, there isn't a lot of history being taught now. Now it's all techno stuff, and but you are not going to get awards or tenure by going against the grain. Say, yeah, well, actually, you know, the New York Times lied in its teeth about the assassination of JFK, and so did all of the major media, and they lied in their teeth about the killing of his brother Robert and Martin Luther King. They lied in their teeth about the Gulf of Tonkin incident initially that led to the Vietnam War. We may be repeating that now in the Middle East, in the Gulf of Oman. And they lied about so many things. They lied about Gary Webb, who didn't uncover because it had already emerged into public view, but he wrote on the front page of the San Jose Mercury News, which is, you know, the paper of record right here in the Silicon Valley where I've done my work, and he talked about the CIA being deeply involved with the cocaine traffic, which ultimately found its way in considerable measure to the streets of America's inner-city areas and had much to do with the crack cocaine epidemic that devastated those same areas. And right. His work was distorted by his critics, and ultimately he was destroyed as a journalist and then died of a two-bullet suicide. You know, and so there are examples of what will happen to someone if they go against the prevailing order.
Well, a two-bullet suicide, too, though, Mr. Emery, which was preceded by the deconstruction of his entire life, which is left out of the equation. I mean, he lost everything. And then
family and fortune.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, that's
they
what happened.
Them. You know, and it, you know, sometimes when I get angry about these things, I take a look. You know, and again, I'm 70. You know, what people want, they want to be happy. You know, so if you're a journalist and if you have invested a lot of time in getting your degrees and putting together your professional pedigree, and you know you've gotten married and you know, have the family that you may have wanted and so forth. And, you know, you're trying to pay for your kids' college education, you're paying off a mortgage, car payments, what have you. If you then go against the grain and begin telling the truth, you're finished. You know, bye-bye mortgage payments, bye-bye car, bye-bye marriage, very possibly, so long college education for the kids. Mm-hmm. And at this point, really is not, I don't think, realistic for people to expect someone to embrace economic and or professional martyrdom, even if they don't actually become a physical martyr, as Gary Webb appears to have done. And it is very sad. Indeed, that is why I think Mort Saul's observation, how many lies before you belong to the lie? Because they really do. Their lives, and this is not meant to be self-righteous or judgmental of those who decide to take the path of least resistance. You know, at what point does it simply become a useless struggle to tell the truth? The late George Sobeys had many books about this, Tell the Truth and Run. You can't print that, the Lords of the Press. So it is not a new phenomenon. There is a Turkish proverb, Charles, that I really like. He who tells the truth gets chased out of 9 villages. I really like that because it is so true.
Well, and, this has prevailed for a very long time, but, you know, I respectfully need to tell you that this is actually beginning to change. And I'm going to tell you that it's not changing in the way that those of you, and I do mean you, Mr. Emery, who have laid down the path before a lot of us got here. Okay, because when you started your broadcast career, I was 7 years old. I was listening to talk radio because that radio was my best friend, okay? And this is my chosen art form, basically, that I am conveying a lot of these messages with at this point in time, right? But there are a very slim, small amount of individuals out there who are not falling down to the corporate sponsorship, who are not going along with it. And there are opportunities to create independent media now. You can, with your own freestanding stuff nowadays, do things that were unimaginable. There was no way to get radio play. You can purchase that time now if you can find a way to raise the money. You can do a lot of things where you are now in a whole different position. Publishing has also altered due to the nature, and it's the double-edged sword because a lot of garbage has gone out there too, and a lot of propaganda that is meant to distract people from the truth tellers still lost in a sea. But the absolute destruction is not necessarily there. You're not necessarily going to go down all the way. You don't get to live well. I'll tell you that right now. I'm one of these people who is, and you don't know my circumstance, doesn't matter. I'm telling you now that I am not living well, but the facilities to do what it is I'm doing are actually being paid for by the people that support it directly. There's no corporate sponsorship.
There is.
And there's that opportunity there for the direct funding. It reminds me of what it is that I'm sure you could tell people about, which was sort of the underground press that existed, where people printed their own monographs, where people got out information. And here's another piece. I want you to feel good about what I'm about to say to you. I lectured via Skype for the University of Alabama recently for their history department on the Kennedy assassination. Okay. And I was the final speaker, and I was there to discuss the media's role in the Kennedy assassination, okay? And what I discussed is exactly what you just laid out, that all these years the media has been fully funded to lie to you. and that you have been deceived by the things which are out there as part of the culture, indeed, and that the truth is available on a great many levels. Do we have the absolute A to B to C to D, all the way to Z conclusion in there just yet? Not necessarily. But there are people that are still working on it. There are people that have not surrendered. There are people that, regardless of the fact that they could really make a lot more money if they didn't do this, they could survive a lot better if they didn't do this, their books could be bestsellers because they have that talent, their radio shows could be international successes if they chose to, and yes, and yes, and yes, but there are still people there that are going to say, you know what, I'm going to do this anyway. And it's being done. And I wanted those young people in that class to know that the next step is theirs. I'm in my 40s. I'm not a college student. I'm not, you know, you're like my dad's age. You're a little older than what my dad would have been had he not taken his own life after serving in Vietnam.
Oh, wow. That brings me, I'm very sorry to hear that, but the you know,
but don't
I am
be
in
because
that Vietnam
but
generation and people really yeah. don't understand not only that JFK was pulling us out of Vietnam, which is one of the reasons he was killed,
which is another point I made during that.
What happened?
I made that point very, very clearly during that presentation. This was literally my motivation. Just let me finish this one part, and then please, I want to hear exactly what you have to say. Because the thing is, I wanted to let them know what my motivation was. And yes, indeed, that was one of the primary movers, is that to me that, yes, today we have the longest standing military conflict in our history, in this nation's history. But the body bags have not come home yet that came home with that war. The other part of it, though, is coming home and is not being understood, and that is there are, by any man's count, at least 1 million men that were returned back to this country mutilated, either physically, psychologically, or spiritually. And if you mean to tell me that that doesn't mean that there were 1 million families that didn't have to be affected over something that didn't need to happen, then I don't know why you care about the assassination, because they were there to study the assassination. And I said, if you don't see it through this lens and you don't see that this is a thing that must not be repeated, then I don't know why you're listening to anything else I'm going to say. Then I went on into the media and why it is that, you know, and laid it out for them and talked about how the Warren Commission, when it came out, CBS was already in the middle of a 2-hour program and et cetera, et cetera. But understand this. It is people like you. John Barber played a role in this in my mind, too, but it's because of his media creation. He's a unique individual. I love that guy. And I've been privileged to have him on this show many times. But
by the way, Chelsea, I'm not familiar with him. Can you briefly tell me about who he is? Not a knock on him or you in any way. I'm just not familiar with him.
No worries. John Barber created the television show Real People. He also did two documentaries on Jim Garrison, the Garrison tapes. Okay, and the
I've heard of that. Yes, yes.
Yeah. So that's who he is. But May Brussel. Okay, you. Some of these other individuals who did shows about the Kennedy assassination, usually around the anniversary or whatever, when I was that little kid listening to it, okay, and the realization that I got to through the work of somebody like John Newman, which is where I first discovered it, that the Vietnam War did not have to happen, basically, because we would have been done with it in 1965, all U.S. personnel would have been withdrawn. And the, you know, National Security Action Memorandum 263. Sorry, I got to tell you, you know, and I know you've heard it 1 million times, Mr. Emery, but that is the key to me, that it is about making it so that we do better going in the future. You know, because some people say to you about this, you know, why is it you're still talking about the Kennedy assassination? I went to the Lancer conference a couple of years ago. Well, it's 2017. I went to the Lancer conference. You know, they gave me an award, a Mary Farrell Foundation award. My presentation wasn't even about, you know, showing my research, which I've done a lot of, and a lot of real research. I don't mean just going on YouTube and watching videos. Never forget that when you're listening to a guy like Dave Emery. This is a guy who went through documents and actually interviewed people and, you know, really did research, okay? When you get into that, there is always a motivating factor. And for me, it's about that war, which did not need to happen. It's about all of the collateral damage that came from it. And as far as I'm concerned, it's time to make sure that we do not repeat that. Now, that's there's more issues.
Sadly,
but that's
we already have. I mean, we went into the Gulf War
right
behind bogus intelligence. And this just ludicrous video. I mean, I am not a video expert. It doesn't even look good.
No, it doesn't.
The alleged video, I think it's a deep fake video. Certainly some sort of concoction. The shadows don't look quite right. And supposedly this was an Iranian covert operation, and they wanted to show what they could do but didn't want to be identified as doing it. And that's why they put a limpet mine above the waterline, then went out in a boat in broad daylight wearing Revolutionary Guard apparel, and did. I mean, it isn't even a very good provocation. The whole Russiagate thing. I haven't got time to go into the technical aspects, but it is pure unadulterated BS. The hacks, if one knows anything about tech, the high-profile hacks make no sense whatsoever as being Russian hacks. I mean, the very first one, supposedly, of the DNC, was done on an outdated PAS shell. Once there has been a hack, the malware is available on the dark web, and whoever did that attack hardwired their IP address into the malware. No hacker is going to do that. It's like people pretending to be Lee Harvey Oswald all over the South, including while the real Lee Harvey Oswald was in the former Soviet Union, in order to create the legend. But among the things that are cited as proof of, quote, Russian interference in our election is a group of Facebook posts coming out of Russia. Well, first of all, cyber matters are very easy for someone with the right skills to fake. Even NSA can have a hard time if the people whom they're ranged against are good enough. But there were a total of 80,000 Russian posts on Facebook. How many of them were the government? How many of them were false cyber false flag? Who knows? But that is out of a total of 33 trillion Facebook posts over the same time. In terms of numbers, that comes out to 1/415,000 of 1% of the Facebook posts. And we're supposed to believe that this, you know, helped swing the election for Donald Trump. I mean, there is so much nonsense. I was a freshman in high school when Kennedy was killed, and it was the summer between my freshman and sophomore years when the Gulf of Tonkin incident happened. That was a much more innocent time. But one might think that people would be a little more savvy about things at this point, but our media just are not doing their job. You know, if in fact we wind up in the shooting war in Iran, That might prove to be the lesser of two evils. Russia is, and we haven't got time to do justice to this, but Russia is absolutely correct about what's going on in Ukraine. We have put in the key positions in Ukraine the old OUNB fascists who are allied with Nazi Germany. They jumped to the CIA with the Nazi Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit. They remained as part of the old world anti-communist league and the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, and as part of the Republican Party's Ethnic Heritage Outreach Council, and then were projected back into the former Soviet Union when it broke up. And these are absolute Nazis. They aren't just Holocaust deniers, they're Holocaust celebrators, and this is a matter of public record. And yet we're being told that anyone who tells the truth about these things, and the truth is very well documented, is a Russian dupe or a Kremlin dupe, if not an actual Russian agent. And if anything, I think our mainstream media, and an awful lot, I'm afraid, of the progressive media, have gotten worse. You know, it's like they're addicted to this stuff, and just the lies are just becoming more and more institutionalized. And certainly, Charles, with the Internet, and related technologies, it is possible for people to get a lot more truth out there. It's also possible to get a lot of BS. I just see so much nonsense out there, you know, about September 11th. My goodness, it is really sad, and it impacts me to hear that your father was a Vietnam vet who took his own life. Because I've worked with some veterans and organizations, and aside from the war itself, you know, how we got in there, what actually took place with regard to the GIs themselves. We lost many more soldiers than we were told. There was one guy I know who served two tours in Vietnam, the second one as what was known as a tunnel rat. He went down into those long, deep underground mazes looking for enemy troops. And he was part of an understrength platoon that went into the rainforest. They were ambushed. He and one other guy came out alive. Those are the only two guys of the 33 that went in who weren't killed. The other guy was killed later. And yet that week, when you listen to the broadcast, the total number of killed in Vietnam was less than what his platoon had lost. And I've heard so many different GIs talk about that. I had a very close friend named Lee, that's L-E-E, Childress, C-H-I-L-D-R-E-S-S. He was a sergeant. And there is a book called Everything We Had by Al Santoli, S-A-N-T-O-L-I, and it has a brief quote and a picture of Lee as a young GI. And it talks about when their position was overrun. He was with an outfit called the 305th Helicopter Assault Battalion. And what is not mentioned in that piece about him in Everything We Had was that this was during the Tet Offensive. The night before, a bunch of helicopters came, or the day before, a bunch of helicopters came in, and they helicoptered out all of the E-6s and above. In other words, every non-commissioned officer from roughly, I think that would have been a master sergeant and above, were helicoptered out. And then they were overrun that night. They were destroyed. Then the next day, the helicopters came back, and all of the E-6s and above came back. And it was the only time Lee said he ever saw an officer kiss a blank blank. He said there was a lot of eye contact. The point being that the powers that be knew that they were going to get overrun. All they were interested in was bringing those enemy soldiers out into the open so the massive American firepower, air power, artillery, and so forth, could kill vast numbers of them. They weren't concerned with the guys in that base. So basically like ants. They were stationed like over the Cooch tunnels. It was a tunnel complex big enough to stretch from San Francisco to Monterey. And the only way that they could get at them was to bring the enemy troops, that is, to have them come overground. It was like an anthill. If you've got an underground ant colony, you've got to put some bait up on the ground to draw them out into the open. And that is what his unit, the 305th Helicopter Assault Battalion, called the Black Spot, they were the bait. And they didn't care. They were cannon fodder in the most literal sense of the word. They were there to draw enemy troops into attacking them, so the massive, amazing American firepower, the heat, the air power, the artillery, could get at them and kill vast numbers of enemy troops. It was as cynical as anything I could imagine. Although the Marines didn't do this, the Army in many places in Vietnam where there was a lot of combat, the officers only served six-month tours of duty. The conscripts, the GIs, served 11-month tours, which I'm sure had much to do with the fragging of officers that took place. You're going to be out of here after 6 months, and you want me to go in and get killed? You know, I'm sorry. And they threw toss a grenade into their hoops. It's just the suffering and the sin of the GIs themselves who actually served there, and the cynicism on the part of their command structure, at least the higher-ranking officers, is just unbelievable. And
Well, you know, I actually feel as though I need to interject something here and ask your opinion about it. Because sure. I look at this from an even more cynical standpoint. Certainly, look, you got my personal connection. And when I attempted to apply, by the way, to be a beneficiary of a military veteran, okay, the U.S. government denied that he even had a military record, my father, right? And that is a battle that took almost 20 years to correct. Now there is that, and I found out why. It's because initially when he was brought in as a for construction reasons, and they found that he had a talent with a rifle, and he was then repurposed as a sniper. And it appears to
Army or Marines?
Army.
Army, okay.
Okay, and he was repurposed as a sniper. So interesting sideline to this is what follows that I learned later on and could observe firsthand in some ways. And that is, you know, you mentioned the crack cocaine with the CIA. Well, you know, Vietnam brought us, it seems to me, a lot of cheap heroin to the streets of the United States.
No doubt about it. There's a great book called The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia by Alfred McCoy, excuse me. I use that in large measure for AFA program number 24. You bet there was a lot of cheap heroin, and it was being used to finance not only the Hmong tribesmen, our so-called secret army in Laos, but also it was being used for counterinsurgency purposes in Vietnam itself, and was being deliberately trafficked to the GIs.
Correct. Absolutely correct. And you read Doug Valentine's work on this as well, I bet.
I'm familiar with his book, The CIA's Organized Crime, and I've read some of his other work. But, I'm familiar with Douglas Valentine has done fabulous work.
Right. I've been extremely...
He did the definitive book on the Phoenix program, then a two-volume series called The Strength of the Pack and The Strength of the Wolf about our narcotics, quote, enforcement, unquote. And then did another book in which he incorporates part of all three of those, called The CIA's Organized Crime.
Correct. And that's exactly what I had him on this show to discuss, is exactly the works you just cited. But I also compare it to the short-lived or shorter-lived, and I feel as though might be rebooted very soon, cocaine trafficking program that took place. You know, and for that, what did I do? I got Celly Castillo. I don't know if you're familiar with him. But you want to talk about former DEA agent?
Yes, I am.
I've had him on the show. But I also got Ricky Ross to come on here and talk about it. Freeway Ricky Ross. And you know why?
Yep.
Because the two bookends made perfect sense to explain this. And, you know, here it is. There is a war of drugs that is occurring as well, and it serves many purposes. It does pacify the population. It, obviously profitable, because otherwise nobody would engage in it in the first place. But it does a lot of damage. Now, you link it to today's opioid crisis, and you think about it very carefully, and you take a look at where a wonderful place to grow all of that stuff that heroin is made from. You know, I'm being intentionally vague here, but that would be Afghanistan. And
Do you think so? I mean, I'm being facetious.
It's okay. Be facetious.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Yep.
You know, this is the thing, though, is because these things have not been properly answered. And again, when I was growing up and learning to read newspapers, I heard about the aftermath of Watergate and read about the investigations in Congress, including the House Select Committee and, the Rockefeller Commission, all that wonderful stuff that was seeming to come out as if the government was now revealing some of its dirtier business. But truthfully, none of it ever got to the core, in my estimation, of exactly how dirty it is. And here's the thing. I don't believe that we have any more time left to wait for more whistleblowers to emerge to do any of that. I think we need to speak directly to these issues. And I'm telling you again that I just want you to know, you don't know me, but I partially know you, because I've been listening to you. And before I probably run out of time with you tonight, because we are going just a touch over regular time in case you're listening live. I started late, so we're going late. The thing is, I wanted to get back to the concept of fascism and what it is you were talking about, and you know, what you are truly motivated by. Because it's virtually the same thing that that I am motivated by, with a slightly different personal story. We've all got a personal story. Okay, but the fact is that this is that this, in my estimation, is a fight that not only needs to be engaged in, but we do need to achieve discernible victories here. Unlike these conflicts that are costing young men their lives with the best of intentions, I do not fault servicemen for their service. I do fault the individuals who do this under false pretenses, whether they are wantonly destroying a sovereign nation under false pretenses like Iraq, or if they are doing damage to the people of Afghanistan while loosing more drugs on the world, or if they are, you know, forget about the American cost in Vietnam. How many Vietnamese people actually died? Historians can argue between 1 and 4 million, and I don't argue with any of them. That's a lot of bodies. For what? Anyway, Dave, I would really like to talk to you about anti-fascism and, again, your motivations and anything you want to throw in here, because, again, I know I don't have all day with you, but I would love to speak with you again on more focused topics, if you like, whatever it is you like. In fact, if you want to come back on here, I'd like to cross-pollinate you, because I'm telling you, there is a lot of different subgenres out there now. Everything is so partitioned off when it comes to the media, when it comes to awareness, when it comes to information. I think that those of us who are literally truly marching in the same direction need to cross-pollinate quite a bit more. And I think in that way, that's the only way that we're going to become sizable enough to fight the larger machine that we are confronted by.
Absolutely. So let me see if I can do this just in a minute or so left. You talk about drugs. I think they're doing the same thing to the blue-collar workers who are being put out of work in the heartland of America. The largest of the cartels that were put together, and that buttressed Adolf Hitler, was the Bayer Company of I.G. Farben. They discovered aspirin. I.G. Farben, put together by John Foster Dulles and bolstered by his brother Alan Dulles of the Warren Commission at CIA. They invented heroin as a cure for morphine addiction and also as a cough suppressant, especially effective in children. Well, that turned out to be even worse than morphine. In the run-up to World War II, they developed a synthetic opiate called Dolefine, in honor of Adolf Hitler, because they felt that the British naval blockade would deny them sources of access to sources of raw opium to treat casualties. So they created Dolefine, named in honor of Adolf Hitler. Well, after the war, they had this, and they had no use for it, and they didn't want to use a drug named after Hitler, so they renamed it methadone, and then use it to treat heroin addiction now. And that kind of tells you the whole thing in a short amount of time.
Mm. In clinics established by the Rockefellers and all of those other wonderful power elites who are out there with their non-profit organizations, to give you the methadone clinic, which once again gives you the answer to the addiction they already gave you, which gives you another addiction, and then they can give you another answer. And hold on, it sounds like Hegel might be rolling over in his grave because the dialectic is being played out. That is truly the drug paradigm. And you cite precisely, I don't know if I got it from you. I might have got it from you in my head the way I recite that, because I exactly point this out. That, you know, morphine was an interesting thing. They gave it to you for everything from menstrual cramps to, you know, to a toothache to so on and so forth. Everything morphine was great for. But morphine addiction, here's heroin to answer that. And today, the fact that the Bayer aspirin company has bought Monsanto is...
Yep.
And
they bought Monsanto, and the deal, their American counsel was Sullivan and Cromwell. That was the law firm of John Foster and Alan Dulles.
That's it. That's the ball game, if you will. But, Dave, I really appreciate you taking this time. I mean, look, I've got another hour to work with. I mean, I know that you have limited time, so I'm going to let you go. But fact is, I would like people who, if you have not encountered Dave Emery, or you think you have, because here's the fun thing, too. You know, Dave, that for a while people had traded tapes when there were tapes to be traded, and people trade MP3 yep. files. So quite honestly, your stuff has gotten out there to people who don't even know who you are sometimes, and it has been spread around and repackaged. And I want one of those flash drives, by the way, that you talked about for $65. Sure. I'm sorry the money doesn't go to you, but I want to get one of those, so I'm going to find a way to get one.
If you want, you can make those available on your website. The only thing is you'd have to charge $70 so that you know, you're not making much. But yeah, I'll send you a link.
Send me the link. Send me the link, and it'll be there for free. I don't want to profit on it. It'll be there for free if people want to go take a look and get your entire collective work on a flash drive. No compensation for that. It's just going to be there. And anytime we have a talk, I'll make sure I put it back out there. But in the meantime, also your website that, you would like them to start at to take a look at your work. I mean, you can find Dave Emery on YouTube and all the other places you hear somebody who has got something interesting to say along with the chorus of crap that is on YouTube. Yes, you can find Dave Emery on YouTube, but don't go through there because some of it's edited. Some of it doesn't come from Dave. I don't suggest that. Where do they go to get to Dave Emery directly and your work?
SpitfireList.com. That's one word, SpitfireList, like the British World War II pursuit aircraft.com. And I don't make any money from anything on that website. There is a place, a link you can click on if you want to contribute money. There also is a link to get to the flash drive, but I think that is now somewhat outdated. But I will send you the link, and it is there. That's where I put this stuff out, because there is no way one person or even a whole bunch of people could set the ship right. And ultimately, it will be done or will not be done by posterity. And this is my contribution to that.
Right. And, you know, I do not have the volume of work or the type of work that you've done in my own way. That is precisely what this show is here for. But definitely we're going to give you guys those links. Email them to me, Mr. Emery, please, and I will make sure that they go up on the website, and they'll show up in some other places too, just because I have the ability to do that. Okay. One quick question before I go, though. In the next hour, I'd kind of like to play for my audience the Gordon Novell portion that we were talking about. Do you think there would be any issue with me doing that, or?
Oh, no, absolutely. No, I have the copyright, you know, executive, whatever. Sure, absolutely, go ahead. And if you want to have me back on the comment afterward, you know, I'm free. So, dude, you're calling that. Absolutely. Play the tape. And, you know, what is so interesting is there are a lot of things, but how many different links between the investigation into JFK and Nixon, his first choice as a defense counsel was Arlen Specter, who created the single bullet theory. His first choice as Watergate special prosecutor was J. Lee Rankin, who was in charge with overseeing whether Lee Harvey Oswald had any intelligence connections. His second choice was John J. McCloy, a member of the Warren Commission. He had Gordon Novell, who was going to erase the Watergate tapes. There was a guy named Charles Kane, a Warren Commission counsel, who was the counsel for Rosemary Woods. Mm-hmm. And it is amazing how many different people. Leon Jaworski, who became Watergate special prosecutor, was a Warren Commission counsel, was on the board of directors of the MD Anderson Fund, a CIA domestic funding conduit, and he also was the co-counsel of the Texas Court of Inquiry, the Texas body put together to investigate, unquote, the JFK assassination. His co participant, a guy named Robert Story. As Colonel Robert Story had passed down the word informally that the denazification edict at Nuremberg was to be relaxed, and that there are so many different connections between Watergate and the JFK assassination.
It well, is, one amazing. Of the gentlemen you just mentioned was also the vice chancellor of post-war Germany. When they were making those determinations, if my memory serves me correctly, wasn't McCloy that person?
Yeah, his actual title, he was the U.S. High Commissioner for Germany. Yep, and he released many of those Nazi war criminals into the service of the U.S. military.
And, right.
Jaworski, I have a post on the front page of my website right now. Jaworski had overseen the trials of Dachau medical personnel who had killed people in experiments. Five of the key doctors were already working for Project Paperclip and the U.S. Army Air Forces at that time.
Right.
So when you've got Leon Jaworski and Robert Story heading up the Texas Court of Inquiry, they both have histories of helping to cover up Nuremberg. You have John J. McCloy, Alan Dulles worked hand in glove with these people. Most interesting indeed.
See, I might want to just have you on to talk about the Nixon nexus, because, and I'm going to end this portion of the show on this note. I'll let you comment on it, but the Nixon nexus kills me because there was a couple other interesting characters wandering around the Nixon administration, and we know them today. Lee Atwater, along with a guy named Roger Stone.
Yeah, well, Roger Stone was, I'm not familiar with Lee Atwater and Nixon, but Roger Stone was a dirty tricks specialist for Richard Nixon. He was a protege of Roy Cohn. Nixon actually is a very interesting guy. He was a protege of Alan Dulles, and his first congressional opponent was a guy named Jerry Voorhees from Los Angeles. Jerry Voorhees was leading the fight on the floor of Congress to break up the German cartels, in particular I.G. Farben, which I alluded to, part of which was Bayer.
Mm-hmm.
Nixon was a protege of Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles was the speechwriter, really the campaign manager for Thomas Dewey, who ran for the Republican ticket in 1948. His vice presidential candidate, by the way, was Earl Warren, later Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who headed up the Warren Commission.
Although in actuality, here's the funny thing about the Warren Commission. You really should call it the Dulles Commission. And why do I say that? Because if you actually examine the records and you take the time to understand who is the most active questioner, who is the most active participant in the executive sessions, who is the most active member of the Warren Commission during all of these interesting meetings where they were deciding about the official story. You might as well call it the Dulles Commission. It really,
absolutely.
I mean, in a mathematical sense, you cannot deny this. I'm not talking about my impression, my opinion even. I'm talking about mathematically. If you lay this out, there is more activity from Alan Dulles all the way throughout the proceedings than there is from the man who the commission is, you know, that's actually not the name of the commission, the Warren Commission, but nonetheless, the man who is generally named, for it, is not the guy who is really seeming to run the show. Isn't that just priceless?
Yeah, well, this is why the deep politics are so interesting, because, again, Warren was Dewey's vice president, a vice presidential candidate, and Alan Dulles was running that campaign. When Dewey narrowly lost, it was blamed on the, quote, Jewish vote, unquote. To counteract that, a covert operation was put together, which is ongoing and inseparable from the Republican Party. It was called the Crusade for Freedom. It had two basic components. One was supporting armed combatants associated with or composed of elements like the OUNB, the Ukrainian fascists who fought with Hitler, various other Eastern European fascist groups who were grouped under the Nazi Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit. And this actually constituted not only a covert operation, but a continuum of warfare, guerrilla warfare, from the closing days of the Third Reich on up through the CIA. In effect, they simply changed uniforms. And on the domestic side, there was a program put together to import these same Eastern European fascists, the Ukrainian OUNB, the Croatian Ustashi, the Bulgarian National Front, the Romanian Iron Guard, the Latvian Vanagas Group, and others. And they were installed as leaders in many of the Eastern European ethnic communities in the so-called Rust Belt, that voted for the Democrats in order to woo them over to the Republican side. What this became was quite literally a Nazi branch of the Republican Party. I mean, Nazi ad with a capital N, and its roots were mired firmly in the Third Reich and in the Nazi Reinhard Galen Eastern Front spy outfit. By the way, Galen's liaison with the Americans was approved by Karl Dönitz, Admiral Karl Dönitz, who succeeded Hitler as the chief of state, head of state for the Third Reich, and by General Franz Halder, who had been Galen's chief of staff, indicating that the chain of command for the Third Reich was still in effect. Now, Alfred, again, a Nazi branch of the Republican Party, which also was inextricably linked with a continuum of warfare in Eastern Europe. It was put together by Alan Dulles, but it was overseen by Dulles' protege, Richard Nixon, the guy who was the chief spokesperson for this outfit, the Crusade for Freedom, was Ronald Reagan, the guy who oversaw most of the State Department machinations to bring these people into the U.S. was William Casey. And this group, the Republican Ethnic Outreach Heritage Council, was viewed as being able to deliver the swing vote in five key states in presidential election years. But they had only recoalesced every presidential election year until it became a permanent part of the Republican Party. That was done under then-chairman of the Republican National Committee, George H.W. Bush, the man for whom CIA headquarters is named. So when you have Ronald Reagan coming to power in 1980, he was quote, elected, unquote, with a lot of aid by Roger Stone, by the way. He was the chief spokesperson for this Nazi branch of the Republican Party. His campaign director and later his CIA director was William Casey, who handled the State Department machinations to bring these people into the U.S. His vice presidential candidate was George H.W. Bush. And although Nixon himself was out of office, if you look at Ronald Reagan's early cabinet appointments, it was basically Nixon too. You had Caspar Weinberger, a Nixon cabinet member who was Secretary of Defense. You had George Shultz, who was a Nixon cabinet veteran, who I think his first title was Nixon's Labor Secretary, I think, under Nixon. I've forgotten what George, I think he was Secretary of State initially. You had General Alexander Haig, who was Chief of Staff at one point. I think he became Secretary of State. The National Security Advisor was Richard Allen, who was a Nixon veteran. And William Casey himself had been Nixon's head of the SEC. So when Reagan comes to power, what you are seeing is a hands-on and across-the-board manifestation of this continuum from the Third Reich to the CIA to the Republican Party. And it's quite remarkable. And so you have Nixon. When Richard Nixon died, it was the only good thing he ever did, and he was 81 years late on that. He has emerged as something of a sympathetic figure. He wasn't as bad as many people who came after him, but that's true of quite a few people. It's like saying John Dillinger wasn't as bad as Charles Manson. True as far as it goes, but...
Charles Manson wasn't as bad as Jeffrey Dahmer either. Still, it's...
Yeah.
Okay, I get Nixon that. And you know what? Nixon, to me, is almost a sympathetic figure at this point, considering, I hate to say this, but considering what it is we have going on now, you know, it just, I'm sorry, I had to throw that in, but you can watch these things. The Nixon Nexus might be the thing that I talk to you about next, because, you know, even here's a weird little factoid that I'm just going to throw in here, and I don't want you to explain it, Mr. Emery, because we're just going to end on this and let people consider it in their minds. There were three wounded people in Dealey Plaza in a very technical and sort of, you know, just forensic sense. One of them, who I used to talk to all the time, it was James Tague, and he was the guy they called the third wounded man. He might have been struck by something, whether it was a piece of cement or a piece of a bullet, in the face, and he was cut. Very minor wound. Next, of course, we all know President Kennedy was murdered. Public execution, broad daylight, we get it. Okay, but you know there was another guy who is not often talked about, and that is Governor Connally. And interesting thing about Governor Connally, although he was a Democrat for sure, you know, this odd bit of knowledge always dances around in my head, and I'm not sure how to create a web out of it, but he winds up being part of the Nixon cabinet at some point, doesn't he?
Yeah, he became, I think, Treasury Secretary under Nixon and was tarred with the Watergate brush. Mrs. Connally, when John Connally was struck and wounded, she said, "My God, they are going to kill us all," unquote. Mm-hmm. And so one wonders if she knew something. There is a very good book called Family of Secrets by Russ Baker, who goes into, at some length, the George H.W. Bush's activities vis-a-vis the assassination of JFK. It is most interesting indeed.
Well, the most interesting part about that story, though, as far as that third wounded man, not only does he cross, you know, the red and blue line there, but I finish on this. When he died, there were many people who went directly to Nellie Connally and requested, "Please, can we extract from your husband the pieces of metal which were still in his body at the time he was buried?" And she denied it. And the reason why that was requested is because, well, you know, if we could prove that these particular fragments were not part of any of the exhibits that have been presented to us as evidence in the Warren Commission, there's an interesting array of possibilities that would arrive from real solid, first-hand, actual forensic evidence. And what was Nellie Connally's answer to that? No. Just so you know.
Yeah, well, and in fact, it is, I suspect, and who knows what sort of threat may have been delivered to Ms. Connally, or even what Jim Garrison referred to as intimidation by induction. Certainly, Nellie Connally, she's old. She knows what happened. And she also knows what happened to a lot of people who might have wanted to tell the truth. And she may have just decided she wanted to live out her declining years in peace and not become yet another martyr for nothing, because that's what would have happened. Or maybe they would have gone after one of her kids. But with regard to the single bullet theory, and again, Arlen Specter, who developed that completely impossible, quote, theory, really it's more of a fantasy, but he was Richard Nixon's first choice as a defense counsel in Watergate. And the fragments of the bullets that were recovered from the various wounds supposedly made by that one bullet were subjected to spectrographic or neutron activation analysis, which actually analyzes the molecular structure of those fragments. And it was determined that there were differences in those fragments. And then J. Edgar Hoover said, well, they were not significant differences, which was obfuscation, because any difference whatsoever in the molecular structure of those fragments is fundamentally significant. What it means is that they were from different bullets, and the single bullet theory was so much fresh fertilizer, and that there was obviously a conspiracy. And
Well, you know what the sad part about that is? You know what the terribly sad part about what you just went through and what we all had to learn about as part of, you know, sort of the JFK 101, if you're going to study the evidence, reality, is that when you actually dig into it, neutron activation analysis and the methodologies that were employed there were invalid. That's the horrific part of all that, is that they had everybody chasing their tail over this, over a completely piece of junk science. I mean, and you even see where you have, you know, Gwynn showing up in more than one place. Now I'm talking inside baseball here. I don't mean to do this because, you know what, we can get into this for probably the next, I don't know, 7,000 hours or so. I'm not sure how many hours you've recorded, but I'm just thinking that it probably would take 7,000 hours to really break down every single piece of work that you've had to look at in order to get at this. But it's so funny with this neutron activation analysis and bullet lead analysis and, oh, well, what about the position of the bones and exactly what it is we're looking at, and what about the beveling, which turns out to not be accurate. It is such a jungle to have to try and navigate through to be even begin to comprehend the evidence. I find it sometimes insurmountable to explain to someone who is not already steeped in it exactly how far you have to go to break these things down. You not only can't trust the investigators, but you can't trust the investigation or the methodology half the time, because it just becomes something else. Yeah.
I just did, not just, but in late 2018 and the first couple of months of 2019, I did 25 one-hour interviews with Jim DiGenio about the second edition of his book, Destiny Betrayed, just about the Garrison investigation. And the entire official version is simply ridiculous. I mean, Lee Harvey Oswald, aside from the fact he was a lousy shot and could not have done what he did, I mean, he supposedly had defected to the Soviet Union with top secret information about radar maps, was never prosecuted, wasn't even, I mean, it just is ludicrous. He was arrested. He supposedly had fired 3 shots from a bolt action rifle and 3 more from a handgun, and yet he had no nitrate residue on him. The paraffin tests were negative. That just is not a possibility. And, the entire version is just ridiculous. So
the paraffin test, which is not an acceptable test in a lot of places anymore because of all of the troubles that come along with it, if you take a look at when they decided to conduct that paraffin test on him, it's already irrelevant. That is the most hilarious part. And the other thing is, even with that in hand, where they couldn't have turned up the right amount of evidence to do it, they still claimed that based on that paraffin test, they had him. That's the amazing part of that, right? I mean,
the official version is absolutely, if anyone with half a brain, he had been interrogated for hours by local and federal law enforcement. I bet it's to say Oswald, after his arrest, this on Saturday, November 21st, and yet there is no transcript, audio or written, of that interview. The notion that someone who was suspected of killing the president of the U.S. could have been interrogated for hours, and there is no verbatim record, audio or written, of what happened, is simply unthinkable.
Right.
It could not have happened. And the official version, it's not just wrong, it's ludicrous. And then in the wake of the quote conspiracy theory, now there are so many things that have grown up in the internet age, in which they have people out there deliberately muddying the waters. And I don't want to get into September 11th at this point, past the point. But I worked a day job, it's one of the things that has, well, it's cost me. It also has enabled me to do what I do without having to answer to commercial sponsors or to editors or to producers. And I have many years' experience in the building trades. And when the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center theory, and I'm being polite, emerged, I didn't believe that. I was working for a general contractor at the time. I mentioned that to people with whom I work, and they were slack-jawed, because it is not just physically impossible. It's not just demonstrably false. it's physically impossible. And yet there is absolutely the firmest evidence of conspiracy. On March 20th of 2002, FBI and Treasury Department Secret Service people conducted a series of arrests in the Washington, D.C. and Virginia areas, Northern Virginia areas, of people linked to the funding of various terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda. And these people were linked not only to many of them to the Republican Party, to Grover Norquist, to Carl Loeb, but linked to something called the Bank Al-Taqwa, which was founded by a former Nazi intelligence officer named Youssef Nader. He was really a cat's paw for a guy named François Genoux, who was the heir. And check this out for a bit of CV. He was the heir to the collected literary works and political last will and testament of, again, the collected literary works and political last will and testament of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. And a guy named Ali bin Musalim was overseeing an account for the financing of Al-Qaeda with unlimited credit, basically, a bottomless financial account to fund Al-Qaeda. And this was covered up on April 4th, 2 weeks later, April 4th of 2002. A guy named Talat Osman, who was a close personal friend and political advisor to both Georges Bush, and who gave a Muslim benediction at the inauguration of George W. Bush, interceded on behalf of the individuals and institutions who were raided on March 20th of 2002 with then-Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, who was fired. I guess he chose to resign about 8 months later. And the FBI did not pursue that investigation. Talat Altman had been a protege of a guy named Gait Saron of the BCCI, which is one of the drug smuggling links to the Iran-Contra affair. And then he was a member of the board of directors of Harkin Energy, one of George W. Bush's energy companies, the guy who oversaw the, quote, investigation, unquote, read cover-up of the BCCI affair was Robert Mueller, now then head of the FBI. He then covered up the investigation into Operation Green Quest, and now he is the, quote, special prosecutor, unquote, of, quote, Russiagate, unquote. We have a continuity of, on the one hand, covert operations, and on the other, of people who have covered those things up. People have, right, you know, been shocked that William Barr has not been a Joan of Arc, so to speak, in connection with this. Well, William Barr was a, quote, ex-unquote CIA officer who resigned from the CIA along with people like Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins and many of the other operations directorate people when Stansfield Turner conducted a house cleaning of that self-same CIA. He was the guy who was put in to replace George H.W. Bush. George H.W. Bush wanted to continue as head of CIA.
Right, but he only served as 1 year. He only served for 1 year under Ford. And Stansfield Turner was put in there by the one guy who, ever since the last legitimate president, in my opinion, served in the White House, which, you know, ended on November 22nd, 1963, in a street in Dallas. the only guy who had the people's interests in mind ever after, I believe, was Jimmy Carter. He attempted to put somebody in the CIA there in Stansfield Turner that was not a CIA guy. And one of the things that he was effectively able to do was clean house a little bit. But they absolutely limited and restricted his ability to really remake the agency. Would you agree with that as well?
Absolutely, absolutely. But one of the people who resigned at that point was William Barr. Mm-hmm. Then he became Attorney General under George H.W. Bush when he was President of the U.S., And he was the guy who oversaw the last-minute pardoning of many of those key Iran-Contra people. And now, it is so interesting, Robert Mueller was U.S. Attorney for a part of New England, and one of the things he was doing was running Whitey Bulger, the prominent Boston-area criminal. And yep. Even while Whitey Bulger was committing murders, he was serving as a high-level informant for Robert Mueller. Well, Mueller then oversaw not only the BCCI case, but the investigation of Pan Am 103 and Manuel Noriega. All three of those involved not only some of the Iran-Contra machinations, but overlap Iran-Contra drug smuggling. Mm-hmm. And he covers up all of those. Then he becomes head of the FBI, and he covers up the Operation Green Quest raid, which also overlaps BCCI and many other things, and the Saudi Investment Company, or SECO. Then he's appointed as Russiagate Special Prosecutor. And then on the other side, you've got William Barr. And these are the same people that have been sweeping things under the rug for decades. And yet, right. You know, people say, oh, Robert Mueller is just, he's a man of great integrity, you know. And people are shocked that William Barr is the...
No, I you know, and I took a lot of flack as an alternative media guy and as somebody who was definitely not right-wing for saying you guys are out of your mind if you think that Bob Mueller is the key to the truth about anything, because the guy's got a career. The guy's got a career of being a cover-up artist. And, oh, here's his opposition, Bill Barr, another cover-up artist. What does it come down to? There's always going to be cover-ups. There's always going to be malfeasance. And the truth is, these people pass from one generation to the next. And it's like people don't even notice it. Oh, this is new. Nothing is new under the sun. You just got to see where the connections go, and you find out exactly where these things, you know, what soil from whence the, what did you call it, the fresh fertilizer was planted in order to keep growing this stuff. And it's definitely...
I'm a veteran of radio where we have the FCC, so I can't use the S word. I could, because we're not on the air in American radio. But yeah, it is just amazing.
Yes.
And again, the more Saul, quote, how many lies before you belong to the lie? One of the things I found so interesting, finally Whitey Bulger got busted. And he was transferred to a federal prison that was notoriously dangerous for snitches. And he then was promptly murdered. Now, I have no idea whether he was thinking of blowing, spilling some beans on Robert Mueller. I call him Mueller, a deliberate act of disrespect. I don't know if he was planning on spilling any beans. I'm sure he could have, but whatever beans he may have wanted to spill, if he had intention of doing that, will not be spilled now because his blood was spilled. But people never even asked the question. I mean, gee, if this is a prison that is dangerous for snitches, why transfer a snitch to a prison that is dangerous for snitches? He then got killed. And considering that the guy who ran him when he was killing people as well as snitching was Robert Mueller, who was, you know, Mr. Clean, the Russiagate investigator, quote-unquote. It's just, there is a numbing pattern to the whole thing.
No, absolutely. And Dave Emery, this has been an extra long segment here, but I want to thank you, Mr. Emery, for coming on. Again, spitfirelist.com. Go over there, check out Dave Emery's work. And I hope this is the first of many conversations, actually, because I think it would be great to hear a lot more from a guy who can recite this stuff. He's got no notes. He had no preparation. So this is just out of his head. You know, the old expression, they've forgotten more than you know. Dave Emery is one of those guys, and I'm glad to have had him here on the show tonight. Anyway, guys, stick around. The break will come on, and we'll figure out what we're going to do with the rest of our time tonight. But meanwhile, Dave Emery, spitfirelist.com. Go there and check it out. The Ocelli Effect will be right back.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. The brilliant author of The War State brings you exclusive reports about the big changes upcoming in the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Shelly. So I just hung up with Dave Emery, but, you know, normally I would say you're joining us in the second hour, but you're not. It's way late, and I don't even know if we can fit the Gordon Novell portion that I wanted to play from that radio show that we described in the first hour, but let's give her a shot. We'll play at least part of it for you guys, and I guess, you know, we'll have to contain it in the podcast form. You won't hear the whole thing, maybe, but if you go over to SpitfireList.com and check out Dave Emery's work, you can find the complete recording elsewhere. But this to me was one of the most unique things I ever heard on radio anywhere, and I think it's worth sharing it with you guys. So let's take a listen to what happened when Dave was on a show with some people that didn't necessarily know what was going on, and he started talking about somebody who wound up calling in, and that would be Gordon Novell. Anyway, I have full permission to use this, just so you guys know, and Dave will probably return to the show and we'll have more discussions. So let's take a listen to that particular portion of Dave Emery's show.
These days, 575 KOME as we talk with Dave Emery. Let's go to line number one. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air.
Mr. Emery, my name is Gordon Novell. I was driving from Los Angeles to San Francisco when I heard you mention my name, and you state that you're a researcher. And you stated that District Attorney Garrison tried to extradite me from Ohio and that Governor Rhodes refused to extradite me. Well, where I think you failed to address the issue on the thing is, number one, before he attempted to extradite me, I was his chief of security and intelligence for the Kennedy investigation. And I had a serious disagreement with him about what I believed to be a fraudulent case. And when I was in Ohio and was actually going up there to see my fiance to recover a ring, since we were breaking up, Garrison found out from Walter Sheridan at NBC that I had been working with Bobby Kennedy to expose the investigation of Garrison as a fraud. He then charged me with being a material witness in the assassination, so I went in 24 hours. I went from chief of security of the investigation to his most important material witness, and I say, quote, most important material witness, because that's the way he stated it in his press releases. Further, the reason the governor didn't extradite me from Ohio wasn't because of anything having to do with the assassination. Garrison couldn't extradite anybody on the basis of being a material witness or being a witness if they didn't want to. If you're a witness to something and you don't want to cooperate, then you just don't want to cooperate. So what he did is he charged me with being a he charged me, this was in 1967, he charged me and alleged that in 1960, that operating as an agent of the CIA, that I burglarized an ammunition dump to supply some we will call it opposition faction within the CIA with some munitions to carry out after Bay of Pigs activities. That also turned out to be more bull feathers, I guess. And as a result, the governor didn't extradite me. And Mr. Garrison later went on to represent me in a number of other matters. And he and I are somewhat friendly these days, at least I have been in the past with him. But I'm just trying to tell you that you can't make a statement like that without really researching it, and people didn't pay much attention to what anybody had to say at that time except Garrison.
Well, let me interrupt you here at this point, caller, and give you a couple of the sources from which my information comes from. Now, the information that I have about the Kennedy assassination, I'm 35 years old and was 14 at the time Kennedy was killed, so obviously the information that's at my disposal comes from research done with primary and secondary and once in a while primary sources.
We do have a primary source on the air now, Dave.
Well, right. Well, that was my next question. I'm a little bit nonplussed. The person does seem to have a good working familiarity. Perhaps this is indeed Gordon Novelli. I'm a little, as I say, that I'm very.
I'll give you my social security number if that'll help.
Well, okay. Hang on just one second. Let me give the two of the numerous sources on which the account of the Garrison investigation and your situation in particular come from. First of all, a former FBI agent and researcher who's done a lot of writing on not only the John Kennedy assassination, but also the Robert Kennedy assassination.
Well, that's a fellow in San Francisco. He's a former, he's now a private detective, Turner.
Right, okay. You did indeed identify that name. Also a fellow by the name of Bernard Fensterwald, who...
not a fraud.
Well, basically, I personally think he's a CIA agent, but he...
Absolutely.
Well, okay, he wrote a book called... Coincidence or Conspiracy.
He did two chapters about me in the book, both of them fraudulent.
Okay, and the interesting thing is that Bernard Fensterwald was also James McCord's defense attorney. This is really interesting. I'm not doubting what you're saying about being Gordon Novell. I'm very surprised, you know, to sort of be sitting up here on a
talk. I was surprised at 3 o'clock in the morning to be driving down the highway and hearing my name mentioned on the air.
I can imagine. I'm surprised. I'm surprised to be getting a call here. You really did. Is that truly how you just happened to hear about it? You're just driving down the road and heard it?
Going through San Jose en route to LA. En route to San Francisco.
This is great. This is one of the magic moments of radio. Let me ask you a question, Mr. Novell. What do you think of all this conspiracy theory talk? Because it's something that has got to be one of the major dissonant factors in a lot of our consciousness.
I'd also, after you answer his question, I have a couple I'd like to ask you. Again, this is let me emphasize that this is not said in a spirit of malice. I've simply been investigating these things, and
as
certainly,
you know, I've sued a lot of people about this.
Oh, I know, and that's one of the things. That's one of the things I wanted to ask you about too. After you answer Larry's question, I just wanted to say that you know, certainly anybody who's done any serious investigation or reading research, let's say, of the Kennedy assassination realizes that the official version is fertilizer. I mean, it's complete nonsense. So that I just want to say, you know, I want to reiterate that I'm not pointing an accusing finger at you, and none of what I'm saying is done in a situation of malice. Because if you are indeed, and the more you talk, I'm inclined to suspect you are indeed Gordon Novell, because you show a really good working familiarity with the intimate details of this thing. You know, I have a lot of respect for the power you can wield, and I'm not out, you know, I'm not gunning for you or something.
You're right. I like to believe that I'm a one-man army, but that's not the issue here. What I think is the issue is that people just tend to take and say, well, okay, the guy was involved with the Garrison investigation, and he was charged with being a material witness. Now, what is being a material witness? The man put a fifth, and I call him a man, he put a $50,000 bond on me, which at age 26 I could barely cover.
Mm-hmm.
I had to be all of 23 years old when the assassination occurred. He well knew at the time that I was sitting in Toots Shores restaurant with a number of very prominent show business people cutting a contract on Bourbon Street at the World's Fair. I was an entrepreneur with a $5 million project at age 23 at the New York World's Fair. The furthest thing from my mind was the Kennedy assassination. There were maybe 16 people, and yet I've heard, as a result of Garrison, other kooks have come out of the woodwork and have accused me of being the umbrella man and being at Dealey Plaza and firing an impossible shot from a gun concealed in an umbrella, which was a periscope, and all kinds of a signaling device.
Mr.
Novell? I've heard so much BS over the years.
Could I interrupt you?
It caused me so much heartache that every time I get a chance and somebody comes up with it, I have to respond, because the whole thing is while there may have been a great conspiracy, it certainly wasn't Garrison's conspiracy.
Okay, Mr. Novell, let me interrupt you here for a second and explain a little something to the listeners who probably did not understand the reference you just made. There is a fellow, one of the subjects of controversy that's come up in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy concerns a so-called umbrella man. Just as President Kennedy passed through the place in Dealey Plaza where the fatal shots occurred, a fellow, and this was a bright sunshiny day in Dallas, lifted up an umbrella, opened an umbrella in the midst of this sunshiny day. It is, and then twirled it a couple of times, and it is the view of many people who have done research into the assassination, and I must say I'm inclined to agree, that this umbrella served as a type of signal for the fire teams in Dealey Plaza. Now, one researcher, I believe it was Bob Cutler, wasn't it, who accused you of being the umbrella man?
Yeah, well, Mr. Cutler, in 1979 or early 80, came down to New Orleans. He paid me $750 to take a lie detector test. I was the lie detector test, which he selected, the examiner, etc., I passed without even trying. Very difficult. The point that I'm making is that there were a number of test questions, etc. I offered to take truth serum, which I don't know anybody can cheat on that. And I also offered to do a FBI-administered narco synthesis. And I just told him, I said, you can try voice lie detectors, three-pin polygraph, truth serum, or hypnosis. And even though he did that, he still came back and over the years has tried to create himself a niche in the buffdom, it might be a good way to describe the people who look into the thing. By accusing me of literally assassinating the president. And he damn well knows that if I had to call on an alibi, my alibi would be about 17 people who, I again repeat, were sitting with me at Toots Shores as I relieved Mike Todd Jr. of $600,000 for the French Opera House Theater at Bourbon Street for the 64-65 New York World's Fair, which is, it's abundantly proven that I was there. And yet these people who, for whatever reasons, they'll go about playing gadfly, and I'm not accusing you of being that. You seem to be well-researched. They will take photographic enhancements using computer enhancement techniques today, and they will try to superimpose my face or some other poor victim of this game of let's find a conspirator. I worked very closely with the House Assassination Committee and the people who did the fourth gunshot analysis that resulted in a probable conspiracy finding by the House Assassination Committee, Mark Weiss and Ernie Ashkenazi, good friends of mine. I disagree with their findings, although I've worked with them and against them. I worked against them in Watergate for Chuck Colson.
Mr. Neville?
Mr. Fensterwall said that in his book.
The point
I'm trying to make to you is that the Kennedy assassination, if you'd have walked in there with the former chief of security of the CIA, who probably knew what happened, Howard Moose Osborne, and Dickie Helms in 1977, both of them with full confessions in hand and backed up by what other truth-deception criteria examinations could be given them, I'm telling you, they wouldn't have arrested them. Had they confessed, which I'm not saying they're guilty either, I'm just saying that they would be obvious parties to J. Edgar Hoover, Richard Helms, Richard Bissell, Moose Osborne, Mitch Werbel, some of these guys would be the kind, if you had confessions from, I can assure you that neither Sprague Blakey?
Blakey.
Professor removed Sprague as chief prosecutor.
Right. Mr. Neville, let me interrupt you here. I wanted to interject a couple things. You touched on something that I wanted to ask here, and I think, in deference to the rest of the audience here, I think we should take care in our discussion to sort of flesh out some of the details here, because you remember most of the people who are listening to us talk are not intimate with the Kennedy assassination case here. Now, you touched on a subject that I wanted to ask you, and again, I want to reiterate a couple things here at this point. I mentioned it before. You know, the information that I have concerning your alleged role in the Kennedy assassination comes from some of the sources I cited and some others as well. That I've, as I say, I was 14 at the time, and I've just been doing research from secondary and primary sources. I wanted to reiterate, because I am now at this point totally convinced that you are, in fact, Gordon Neville. If not, you're certainly somebody that's gone an awful lot of to trouble to research the facts. I want to reiterate that I'm not, gunning for you or pointing an accusing finger, that these are simply the facts. And also want to reiterate that I have a very healthy respect for your ability to deal with somebody that was, in fact, gunning for you, because I have done some research. Now, one of the things which, one of the connecting links between the investigation of the assassination of President Kennedy and the Watergate case, and here my information that I'm about to cite here comes from one of the books that I referred to earlier, a book called Coincidence or Conspiracy by a man named Bernard Fensterwald, one of the investigators in the Kennedy assassination. I personally think the guy is CIA, although there's...
I know that he's CIA.
Okay, well, there's a lot of good information in his book. Now, one of the things that he alleged in that book was that Charles Colson, one of the advisors of the Nixon White House and rumored by many, or reported by many, I should say, to be about the meanest SOB in a very mean crowd of SOBs in the Nixon White House, that he was recruiting you to, in essence, edit the very famous Watergate tapes using a degaussing gun, and that some speculation had arisen among people who have looked at some of the connections between Watergate and the JFK investigation, have suggested that possibly there may have been a connection between Colson's work, his alleged recruitment of you, and the very famous gaps that appeared in the Watergate tapes. Now, Colson has denied that you were in fact involved, but something which had come to my attention was I've forgotten the exact title, but it was a high technology publication. In fact, it might have been called something like High Technology Review or Technology Review. And it came out, I believe, in the early summer or late spring of 1983. And in that, it referred to a meeting of electronic counterintelligence specials.
Myself, Alan Bell, and Mitch Werbaugh.
Yeah, right. And then in a letter in response to that, you talked about a number of things. You referred to some suits, and you referred to...
I am proceeding against the U.S. Treasury to trial right now. I've been granted... The court has granted me the right to try the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Frame-Ups for the sum of $651 million compensatory for faking tapes in the prosecution that they brought against me because of my creation of the 1984 World's Fair.
Well, the thing that was interesting, there was a statement in that letter you wrote where you referred to your old, I think your exact words, correct me if I'm wrong now, were my ultra-high-technology role in erasing the Watergate tapes. Now...
Yeah.
Was that a misstatement?
Oh, that was an exactly correct statement. Mm-hmm. What happened was Colson asked he had done some back research. He had found out that Watergate had resulted from what we will call an enormous legal miscarriage of justice, which originated from me telling J. Edgar Hoover that I thought he was a raging fag in 1968 when he was harassing me because I sued Garrison and Playboy magazine and I exposed a counterintelligence operation that he had going at that time in the depositions, and he had sent me some very serious warnings about not doing these kind of things, and I told him that I was a free operative and that I did what the hell I pleased, and he made some other rather nasty remarks, so I kind of had a serious little disagreement with him in the Mayflower Hotel's Beef Baron Room, and he then proceeded about 6 months later to charge me with interstate transportation of electronic intelligence equipment, to wit a Crown CRC 6250F tape recorder and AM FM radio built in a briefcase that I purchased in Lazarus Department Store in Columbus, Ohio, and took to Reno, Nevada. That in turn, right prior to that, the professor who headed up the House Assassination Committee after Sprague was removed had penned the laws that created Watergate, i.e., thou shalt not possess a device that is, quote, primarily useful for the surreptitious interception of wire or oral communication, unquote, which became Title III. And I was the first man convicted for possessing such a device. I carry them all the time now. You can buy them anywhere, but the law is still on the books, and the government, i.e., the Justice Department, doesn't enforce those laws because they're patently fraudulent and unconstitutional. But they did enforce them, A, on me, and then about a year and a half, 2 years later, they enforced them on Mr. Liddy and Mr. Hunt et al., possessing Liddy paid Jim McCord $35,000 for a bogus transmitter, which was placed in the Watergate in the first entry, and then apparently malfunctioned, I believe, on cue, and forced him to go back, because I believe that McCord set the whole thing up and that Liddy and the rest of them were a bunch of dupes. But the point I'm trying to make to you is that history in these things is generally rife with, there's some wheat there, but it's ground up into the chaff. And if you don't carefully and microscopically sit down and pick the facts apart, you really don't. All you get is the writer's versions. How can a man go from being the chief of security of the Kennedy investigation, and who actually in great measure promulgated the thing with Garrison, and then find out that Garrison's completely horse feathers, or bull feathers, and then turn around and the next day when we disagree about he shouldn't fake a letter with and superimpose Lee Harvey Oswald's signature onto Clay Shaw's stationery, in order to create non-existent evidence, and we had a very steaming fight about faking evidence. He then charged me with being a material witness, because that's the only thing he could charge me until he fabricated another charge.
Gordon, okay. We only have about 5 more minutes here before we have to leave the air.
There's one more thing I just wanted to say very quickly. Yes, we're going to have to move along here, Mr. Novell. There is just one quick... So, in other words, you deny actually having erased the Watergate tapes.
Only because they didn't pay me.
Okay, well, but in other words, are you saying that...
I did propose to erase all 4,004 tapes. I did the counterintelligence investigation for Fred Bizard and Sinclair and those guys that said that the tape gap was an accident. Alan Bell was the one who wrote the report, the fellow who invented the voice lie detector for me.
Mm-hmm.
And but at the same time, yes, I did propose to erase all the tapes, and it was quite a legal issue. Jaworski said before he died, told me one afternoon, he says it was completely legal, because until the Supreme Court ruled those tapes were evidence, we could have erased them.
Okay, so in other words, here's the point that I wanted to make, is that when I saw that letter that you wrote in that technology publication, I took it from the phraseology as a tacit admission that, in fact, you had been involved in that role. And I'm a little bit confused as to the so you, what you're saying is basically between the lines.
There were 6 reports that said the tape, that the 18 and a half minute tape gap had been done on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
There was a report that never made it in the press because the press didn't want to say anything about it, that destroyed the indictment, that Jaworski and I can't remember the other prosecutor's name had prepared for Rosemary Woods. I had done the rebuttal study and prepared the rebuttal study with Dector Counterintelligence and Security in Virginia that said that it was an accident. And we had effectively gotten in their knickers because there was a possibility that that tape had been accidentally erased. I did not erase that tape. I would have erased every tape in Watergate, and I can assure you, President Nixon wishes I had.
All righty. Well, listen, a couple of things very quickly, because we're virtually out of time here. I just want to say that I'm totally convinced that this is, in fact, Gordon Novell. I wanted to thank you very much for participating and for your remarkable degree of candor on certain subjects here. And I just want to say that that this has been some fantastic radio. Perhaps some of the listeners are wondering, well, gee whiz, hey, we didn't get a chance to call in. This has really been quite amazing that, as I say, this is a fellow who has been alleged by many to have been involved in the assassination. He certainly has denied it and presented a lot of information in backing up his claims. And anyway, it can be said that Gordon Novell is one of the leading figures that has cropped up in connection with the case, not ascribing any guilt to him, and that really those of you in the audience are really quite privileged here to have this kind of a discussion. I want to say, Mr. Novell, also, I consider this personally... as I say, you know, I was 14 when the assassination happened. This is really one of the highlights of my life. It's an amazing thing. Certainly anybody that goes public talking about the kind of thing, and I'm on 3 non-commercial stations up here in the Bay Area, and I'm a, quote, conspiracy theorist, unquote. You certainly the intelligence community keeps an eye on you. You know, I just hope, in fact, that...
Eye on me.
Excuse me?
They keep a very close eye on me.
Oh yeah, I was just hoping, in fact, that that your participation in the broadcast was due just to the fact that you heard this on the radio and stuff. As I say, I'm not gunning for you.
80 miles an hour down the freeway and enjoying the ride when I heard you mention my name unfairly. What I thought was unfairly in the sense that it needed a response because it was not put in juxtaposition with the facts of what actually occurred.
Okay, well, again, I've cited the sources for my information.
I understand the sources, but the sources are erroneous, too.
Okay, well, again, I just want to reiterate that I'm not gunning for you, and as I say, I'm familiar with your situation and have a very healthy respect for your abilities. I just wanted to make that absolutely clear.
Well, you know, I have taken to trouble used to follow me around like a little black cloud, but these days it follows me around like a little green cloud. I took all my talents and applied them to a fellow by the name of DeLorean and managed to do the strategic planning and investigation for that case in the main, and I like the outcome of it. It showed what can be done when somebody really turns the rocks over, and when they don't find a scorpion, they dig under the dirt and find the scorpion.
Okay, Mr. Novell, we're going to have to leave the air, but if you would you hold on for just a second, and we'd like to just thank you again for your most informative phone call.
I just wanted to reiterate
informative.
I want to reiterate for the audience that you know, perhaps some of you are chafing in the bit because you haven't had a chance to call up. But this has really been this is amazing radio. It's very seldom that you get any situation where you get someone whose name has actually been involved with the case. And get a chance to just sort of air some of this stuff out. I'm really nonplussed and quite thrilled, and this is really quite an experience. And I just hope all the people out in the audience, hope some people have taped it, and I hope they put this one in their mental hopper. This is quite an experience. And Mr. Novell, I wanted to thank you for your time and efforts.
Okay, thanks for your call.
All right.
Would you hold on for just a moment to thank you.
Yeah, so we're going to end it right here. Let that ring in your head, that interesting interaction between my guest tonight, Dave Emery, and the formerly living, no longer among the living, Gordon Novell, who is a fascinating character in and of himself. Got to say, I had a good time with this interview. It was rather unorthodox. It was different for sure, but... You know, and I don't necessarily agree with Dave Emery about everything he said. No, I know. But you know what? Credit where credit's due, baby. Anyway, here we go. Remember this much. No matter who you are, where you are, I hope you're well. And remember at all times, I am merely O'Celli. All of you are the effect. Good night.